Yes, welcome to Pop Culture Man Children. I'm Mike Buongiorno. I'm here today with a good friend of mine back on the show, Mike Fischetti.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back. I've missed the show.
I'm happy to see you. Now, we talked recently, and I said, we got to get you back on the show. Anything that's on your mind you want to talk about? And you said, I know how to fix the Oscars. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. And I said, okay.
That is accurate. That's exactly what happened.
I'm excited to hear how you can fix the Oscars, because I'm sure we've talked about this in the past. I'm not an Oscars fan.
Fair enough.
I'm very anti-Oscars.
Totally. You're totally right.
So when you say fix it, do you mean fix the telecast, fix it as a program on television, or fix it as an institution that we respect for some reason?
Oh, no. There's no way you can fix it as an institution to respect. There's not even worth it.
Oh, okay.
The only thing I think we can do is fix it as a telecast and at least make it seem better as an institution. I can't fix it 100%, but you can make it seem a little better.
Okay.
So here's what I've been thinking. I think the one thing that they need to do is, so imagine this. You have about 8 to 10 different categories that are strictly genre-based.
Okay.
So best sci-fi film of the year, sci-fi fantasy, that's 5 nominees.
Okay.
Best drama, 5 nominees. Best comedy, 5 nominees.
Okay.
So on and so forth. So you have about 8 to 10 of these. And then whatever films win in those categories, they are now up for best picture.
So it's like a... it's like a bracket.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's my thinking is just, in reality, the problem with the Oscars right now, especially even within the community of people who enjoy watching the Oscars, is that you can pretty much figure out, you already can tell who's going to win most of the time. There's the campaigning. There's all this sort of extra stuff that goes along with it that basically spoils about 98% of the night.
Yeah. Well, all right. See, here's what I'm hearing.
Okay. Oh, God.
I'm hearing more awards, and I don't know how that's going to help our telecast.
Well,
because it sounds to me like 4 more hours you just tacked onto this. Well, unless we make it like a American Idol type event where it's like a week's worth of stuff.
Not a week, but maybe 2 nights.
Two nights.
You do a Saturday, Sunday kind of thing. And basically, you take care of those 8 to 10 categories along with a few of the others the first night. So then now you've got... now you've got your 8 to 10 best pictures, and now the people who vote for the Academy, they got to vote that day, or like the, you know, within that next day, like they have to vote.
Okay, all right.
So
I got an idea. Go with your idea, but those are the only awards presented, because if you win if say a movie wins best picture, let's say Green Book, crazy. Let's say Green Book wins best picture.
Okay, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Which we're recording this after. It won Best Picture. Let's say Green Book wins Best Picture.
Okay.
It gets director. Like, it should get editor, director. Now, I don't think this is a... I'm just trying to save time, okay?
Okay.
Like, you just get all the... You like, run the board. When you get Best Picture, it's like a full house. You get everything.
Nah, I don't know. I like the idea of awarding as many people as possible. From different movies.
All right, well, we still don't have best casting, right?
We still don't have best casting. We don't have best stunts.
Yes, those poor people.
Yeah, no, they seriously deserve it. Especially now with the level of stunt work.
Yeah.
I think that we're doing or are expecting in movies is very different than...
oh, absolutely.
Maybe 30 years ago.
All right, thinking about your idea, which I like, because I'm somebody who doesn't like the fact that, as a genre movie fan, genre movies don't win unless that genre is sort of, it's either got to be like sepia tone kind of period piece, or something about race, but like super safe about race, Or like, or
you,
like
you could be Gump. Super, you could be super edgy about race, but then you're gonna lose. Like, as long as you're okay with losing, then that's.
I was thinking today that if we were to take the important movies about race from last year
mm-hmm.
and made a scale of them from lame to challenging, it would go yeah. Green Book, and then Black Klansman,
yeah,
and then on the far challenging end, Sorry to Bother You.
Okay.
Which I don't think didn't even get nominated for anything because no, that movie's no. fucking insane. But that was my favorite movie of the year. That in Eighth Grade.
Okay. I sadly have not seen either one. I'm so behind on movies in general.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you see Green Book?
No.
I saw Green Book and I liked it. I liked it. Is it problematic? Hells yeah. Does it have problems? Yeah. Tells the story from the wrong perspective. It mm-hmm. should be from the perspective of Mahershala Ali's character, who was a real person, Dr. Shirley.
Yeah.
It should be his story, but we make it through the story of the white character.
Yeah.
And his son wrote the screenplay, and he's also got issues.
He's
weird on Facebook and Twitter and stuff. But it's a weak script that is overly precious and does that thing where it's like, racism was a problem in the past, but now we fixed it through love and friendship. You know, kind of like,
yeah.
It's one of those things like The Help or The Blind Side, where it's like, it takes one of the most important social issues and like kind of boils it down to something very, very, very safe that you could watch it and go like, oh, I feel good about myself that I watched this movie.
Yeah.
What makes the movie good at all are their performances.
Mm-hmm.
Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali are great in it. Honestly, like,
I could see that.
Them together is, that's the only thing you like watching is them together. Because the script isn't very good. The whole point of it's not very good. The way that they handle Dr. Shirley's homosexuality is bizarre.
I didn't know that he was gay.
He was, but the movie clearly doesn't want to deal with it. Because they're like one issue at a time, America. So the movie just very sort of quickly mentions it and then has the white character played by Viggo Mortensen not have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
When the growth of the character is from Viggo Mortensen being an ignorant racist to not being ignorant racist. That's the journey we take.
Yeah.
But somehow he's totally okay with gay people. Like, it just struck me as wrong. Like, hey, I'm racist. There's a scene in the beginning where he won't drink out of the same glass as a black person.
Yeah. Huh?
I won't drink out of the same glass as a black person, but I'm totally woke when it comes to LGBTQIA issues. Like, really? That doesn't strike me as...
That usually... It doesn't honest. Go like that.
Yeah, usually... Yeah, it usually doesn't go like that. But I was shocked that it won.
Okay.
But
no, I mean, look, everybody pretty much was, because Roma was the, like, odds-on Vegas favorite. And typically yeah. speaking, if they make it the odds-on favorite, chances are it's going to win.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you think, wasn't there a weird distribution with that? Because Netflix was like, it can only be certain places at certain times because we have it.
Yeah, so, okay, well, I mean, so it's very interesting that in this now, the week after the Oscars,
uh-huh.
all of the talk from industry insiders about sort of what happened
yeah.
and what went down and how did things wind up the way that they did. One of the things is that there's definitely a contingent within the Academy who strongly dislikes Netflix.
Uh-huh.
Even though Netflix did, like, you know, abide a little bit by the rules and put Roma in theaters for a yeah. certain period of time. They still felt... Like, no, you have to put it in the theaters for several months
yeah.
before it goes on your streaming service. You can't have it both ways. Like, or you know, you can't just keep pushing the streaming. Movies are meant to be seen in movie theaters.
And if Roma won, it would have been a big boon for Netflix,
yeah.
I think.
And so that's exactly why, like, part of this was them saying, no, Netflix, you don't get to win. You don't get to excel. And also, part of it was that Netflix spent upwards of $35 million
uh-huh.
on campaigning
really?
For Roma. Yeah.
Huh. And I still haven't seen Roma.
Yeah, I still haven't either. It's on, and that's the problem. It's almost funny.
It's on Netflix.
And I know, like, It'll be there.
Yeah, exactly. When
it, like, there's no rush.
Exactly. I've almost watched it a bunch of times.
Yeah, no. That's the thing in general with anything on Netflix that they make.
Yeah.
The way I always feel, people are like, "Have you seen it?" I'm like, "No," but it'll always be there.
Right.
Like it. There's no world where if Netflix produces something,
right,
it benefits for it not to be benefits them not to be on their service.
Right. There's no license that's going to go away.
Yeah.
It's there forever.
Yeah.
All right.
So that was a big part of it.
Right. Also, people are saying it's the worst Best Picture since Crash.
That's pretty
another movie that seems to fix the problem of race relations in 90 short minutes.
Oh, man. You know what's sad though, cuz I met in 2000, I want to say 2008. I met Bobby Maresco.
Mm-hmm.
He was the co-writer on Crash.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually just generally like one of the nicest guys I'd ever met. But it was interesting because, like, if I'm remembering right, the stories that he focused on were like not, or like the stuff that he focused on was not really the stuff that most people find problematic about Crash, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the hate is basically focused on like Paul Greengrass and which sucks because I liked his work on the Bond movies, on the new Craig Bond movies. In terms of,
I'm not a Bond guy,
so like I know that I don't remember if he has story credit. I know he had some influence on, if not Casino Royale, then Quantum of Solace. And I'm one of the only people that really likes Quantum of Solace. I think Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, and Skyfall are the only good Bond movies.
Wow.
Yeah. Hot take. Spitting fire right here.
Wow.
Well, because overall, like, I tried to go back and start with Connery, and it's so boring.
Wow.
They are truly, like, the Bond movies, I think, for the most part, are truly movies of their time. So there may be a point down the road where the Casino Royales and the Skyfalls may seem kind of old cold hat, but I think Casino Royale tells a solid enough story that it actually just works as a movie. You never need to see, if you watch Casino Royale, you never need to see another Bond movie.
But do play totally the GoldenEye N64 game.
Oh, I missed the GoldenEye N64 game.
Because that is one of the best James Bond things ever. Let's talk for a minute about what the Academy is,
because
that's one of the problems I have with this whole endeavor.
Fair enough.
Which is, the Academy is, help me here, it's like a closed group. It's not like a thing where people vote. It's a closed sort of insider group, right?
It's a membership of about 8,000.
Right. And what is the sort of demographic breakdown of these people? On a scale from pale white to slight pink, how white are these people?
I actually don't know what the most recent demographic breakdowns are, because especially since...
Neither do I. I know from the past that it's been pointed out that it's a lot of older white men.
Yeah, typically it's been older white men. I know that they've had initiatives to get younger, more diverse people into the Academy, and it has occurred, and it has arguably...
But how does one get into the Academy? Sounds like the fucking Illuminati.
I forget, like, no, seriously, I don't remember. I think a certain part of it is invitation. A certain part of it is if you've been nominated or if you've won.
So you have to work in the industry.
Oh, you absolutely do.
Yeah.
In fact, one of their ways that they sort of tried to cull or get rid of a lot of the older white men was just by saying, if you haven't basically worked in the industry in X number of years, you're going to lose your... vote. I think if you hadn't voted in X number of years, you're gonna lose it. So they started to cull their list that way.
Another big problem though is that there's almost an honor system when it comes to having seen the films, because the Academy members get screeners, which is just you get a DVD copy or a Blu-ray copy or just a digital link now.
Yeah.
And there's no knowing if people have seen everything, you know.
No.
Just think about this. Think about, like, if you watch the Oscars and you've only seen two of the five Best Picture nominees, and like you're rooting for one of those two, that might also be what the voters are doing. They might have seen two of them and they vote on that. So they're not even, we don't even know for sure they've seen all the movies, but they're still voting on all the movies. And because it's industry insiders, they could be voting on something that their nephew was the best boy grip on or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what, I mean, that's pretty much what happens. There was a story when 12 Years a Slave won a few years back. I'll never forget, some people like freaked out when a story came out and an Academy member admitted, yeah, I didn't see the movie, but
yeah,
you know, just hearing the buzz about it and just feeling like, hey, this sounds like an important way to basically show that we're progressive,
wow,
would be to vote for this film. And
I think that says it all, really.
Yeah, no, that was it. But that's the thing. You're right, and that's why I don't take the Oscars 100% seriously, because there is entirely so much up in the air and so much that, you know,
yeah, that it gets feels missed. The industry takes it seriously.
The industry doesn't. It's weird. It's like it's funny. It's almost like the people who vote for it don't take it seriously,
uh-huh,
but everybody else takes it seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
When
we treat it like it's a serious thing.
Well, yeah, because, you know, we've sort of been conditioned, or for so many years, like, been told, like, it is this important thing.
Right.
And I think there might have been a period of time where it probably was an important thing, or at least it had more respectability about it.
Well, going back, I did some research today on it. I think the first year was 70... No, sorry, the first year was 27, 28, or 29.
I think it was 29 with Wings.
Right. Actually, the first year, there were two, almost like they did this year, where there almost was a popular movie category, and then everyone complained, and they said, okay, we changed our mind. The first year actually had two Best Pictures. There was Outstanding Picture and Unique Artistic Picture.
Oh, okay.
And one of them was Wings, and one was something else. And then, retroactively, they just made it Wings.
Okay, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, the 1927-28 was the first year. So that's the beginning of sound. Mm. So... maybe in your early 30s, 40s, well, I guess movies were taken seriously by then.
Well, listen.
But maybe it did help in the 30s solidifying as an art form.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, because in the 30s and 40s, the people who voted probably actually saw every movie.
Sure.
Especially since it was the dominant medium of its day.
Right, right.
So I could see, that's why I'm like, yeah, the 30s and 40s, I think it works. But the issue is then you have stuff like, you know, in 41, How Green Was My Valley wins over Citizen Kane. And the reason being because of the sort of, you know, underground campaign launched by William Randolph Hearst, mm-hmm, to tarnish the movie and make sure it didn't receive any awards, or at least what's his name didn't receive any awards? Orson Welles.
Yeah.
Because Citizen Kane did win Best Original Screenplay. But the writer was Tom Mankiewicz, I think.
Yeah.
And so that's why it was almost sort of allowed, like, yes, it's not Orson, then it can win that. But besides that.
All right, you ready? I'm going to go through this fast.
Okay.
I'm going to say all the Best Picture winners, and you at home play along, and just tell me if you've even heard of some of these movies.
Yeah, okay.
And you might be, and don't hold your breath waiting for your favorites, because they're probably not going to show up. Wings, The Broadway Melody, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Cimarron, Grand Hotel, Cavalcade, It Happened One Night.
It Happened One Night's pretty good.
Yeah. The Great Ziegfeld, The Life of Emile Zola, You Can't Take It With You, Gone with the Wind. Rebecca is a Alfred Hitchcock movie, but he never won Best Director.
No, and that's
he got a lifetime achievement, though. Same thing with Charlie Chaplin, never won Best Director, got a lifetime achievement. How Green Was My Valley, John Ford. Miss Miniver, Casablanca.
Casablanca, at least, is one of the ones.
Right.
That's one of the actual victories.
Going My Way, The Lost Weekend, Best Years of Our Lives, Gentleman's Agreement, Hamlet. I don't know which version of Hamlet that is.
I think that's the Laurence Olivier version.
All the King's Men, All About Eve, and American in Paris. The Greatest Show on Earth, From Here to Eternity, On the Waterfront, Marty, Around the World in 80 Days, The Bridge on the River Kwai, Gigi, The Apartment, West Side Story, Lawrence of Arabia, Tom Jones, My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music, A Man for All Seasons, In the Heat of the Night, Oliver, Midnight Cowboy, Manhattan, The French Connection, The Godfather, The Sting, The Godfather Part 2, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Rocky, Annie Hall. The year Annie Hall won,
Star Wars
was eligible.
Yeah.
Now, I know there's robots in it. Okay, Academy, but a movie could still be good if it's not about somebody with a British accent or somebody with a disability or something about we fixed race. The Deer Hunter, Kramer vs. Kramer, Ordinary People, Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, One Over E.T., and that movie has blackface in it.
Yeah, wow, that movie looks really bad. With
looking back now, you've got a white actor playing Gandhi. Terms of Endearment, Amadeus, Out of Africa. Come on, 85 was a great year. Well, how about Back to the Future?
Yeah.
How guys, go to your DVD shelf. I want you to pull out your copy of Out of Africa. I'm sure it's right next to your Back to the Future trilogy. See, that's the thing, and I'm not trying to be Mr. like fucking pop culture guy, okay? Yeah. Movies are something we live with. It's a part of our lives, and it hits all of these different facets, and it plugs all these different holes, and it's a part of our experience. But the Oscars is so pretentious,
yes,
and ornate and ostentatious, and just like super super important, and it's all gilded and gold, and you know, movies that we all love don't win.
Yeah, no, listen, that is my big gripe with it, is that, and that's why I was, like, bringing up this whole system of, like, okay, this is why we should nominate films based on genre, and then have those winners go on to Best Picture, because yeah. It at least gives the potential and the chance for films that have not fit into the mold of what is considered Academy Award worthy. It breaks that mold, and now says all genres are basically eligible.
Because whatever you, the winners in those genres get to be contenders for the Best
Picture.
They get
to be contenders. Yeah, that was the way I saw it. And then what that means is, in my opinion, like, hey, that means that some year we might actually have a comedy win Best Picture. Like,
no.
Yeah, I know, crazy. And like, a real comedy, and not to say, okay, real comedy is the wrong way to say it, but like, because Annie Hall is really funny and all, but
I love Annie Hall.
But it is also a melancholy.
Right, it's meditation. It's not a huge, very funny movie.
Yeah, it's got, you know, it's got some. It's not like, I don't know, like, it's funny. So, like, Annie Hall is great, but I almost, like, Play It Against Sam better.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's basically Annie Hall, but funnier and shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Excuse me, I don't want to read this because it's too long, but I'm going through the list of Best Director winners. I'm just going to count all the women.
I think it's one.
One.
Yeah,
it's one.
We got one.
One in
we got one, people.
90 years. Way to go. Way to go. One in 90 years for The Hurt Locker, which is such a machismo, toxic masculinity movie anyway.
A movie about a guy who just thrives on the thrill of violence.
I love war. I can't stand in the cereal aisle. I want to go back to war.
I gotta be honest, I hate that movie.
I remember liking it okay. That's the thing. I'll like something like Green Book, like I'll like it and then it'll win Best Picture, and then I'll be like, well, now I'm actively against you because because you don't deserve accolades.
Yeah. Although what's interesting is then Bigelow's next picture, Zero Dark Thirty, I quite like that movie. I think I think especially by comparison, that's an excellent movie. Now, we could, putting aside the truthfulness of its interpretation
aside of
events,
making torture look like a great awesome thing.
Yeah, yeah. Besides that,
yeah,
like just as a film, it is genuinely good.
Is there any part of you, because when you, with your suggestion of how to fix the Oscars,
yeah,
my worry is what the effect will be on the industry, because now I'm thinking, just the way they make Oscar films, like when they make a period piece, they put a lot of money into it and a lot of money behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be that? Is that going to happen to comedy? Is that going to happen? Because some of these genres are good because they get to play in a field of no pressure because we're just doing the work.
Yeah.
What if now all of a sudden every year there are these big budget comedies that are like trying to go for the gold, or big budget sci-fi movies that aren't being weird and sci-fi and challenging you, but are like trying to be important.
But I don't know. I feel like we'll always have that. You'll always have the movies that are trying to do something and then fail to do it. Like, I don't think it necessarily creates an industry.
I think it creates a genre, in a sense, because I think Best Picture is itself kind of a genre.
Yeah.
Given the system that we have now.
Oh, yeah.
So my worry would be that there's a certain fun horror has, you know, in knowing no one other than what? Silence of the Lambs? And
yeah, besides Silence of the Lambs, maybe Jaws. Exorcist didn't win Best Picture, but Exorcist, I think, was nominated.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like, okay, we're Shudder. We're just this weird thing. My worry is everybody would be sort of running for it.
I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think you definitely have some films that would be over the top and crazy and trying to get that.
Yeah.
But I also, I don't know, I think it would actually, it might give way to some good films.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, this sci-fi movie that it's like, oh, it's too expensive, or what can we ever get out of it? All of a sudden, it's like, oh, this is a potential sci-fi Oscar picture, and then it ends up being a really good movie.
Yeah,
okay. And we all benefit. I think it could benefit. I understand, like, there's definitely, like, downside to it, but sure. I think that there's also the possibility of an upside of films that haven't been able to get budgeting or funding might get that chance.
Oh, sure, yeah. Good. All right, good. Let me ask you this, because I've been thinking about this since Green Book 1.
Okay.
Earlier in the year, the Academy said, we are going to add a new category beside Best Picture, Best Achievement in Popular Film. Yeah. And at first, people were like, what does that mean?
Yeah, they had no...
Steven Spielberg openly said he didn't like it. A lot of people complained. It got roasted on Twitter and then went back on it. And I remember a lot of people at the time going, is this your way of giving a big award to Black Panther without having to give it to Black Panther?
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, okay, we're not going to do the popular movie award. You convinced us, America. But then Black Panther didn't win Best Picture. So part of me wonders if that would have actually been a kind of step in a right direction. Well, rather than seeing it as like second class award.
But that's the thing. I think that does lend towards the second class award versus my idea of like genre based, like, hey, if it's a genre movie and it's the best in that category and then has the shot at Best Picture, like, that's why I think it, I don't know. I think that would be a much better way to be more inclusive of more films, and especially films that people have probably seen. And give them a stake. Like, that's my thing. At the end of the day, what needs to change with the Oscars is that people will watch when they feel like they have a stake. Like in any major postseason, you need the team, the rooting interest.
Sure, sure, sure. See, my thinking is, if you add that award, what you could have is the Best Picture that becomes the darling, the cinema cineast darling, Euromas or whatever. And the popular achievement, that is sort of like what Best Picture was.
That's
your big picture, the one that everyone was talking about. That could be that.
Well, that sounds like what they did in 27 there, in 1927. Right. That actually sounds like it would almost work, is that you have, like, whatever, Best Achievement in Popular Film and then Best Achievement in Artistic Expression.
Yeah.
Which splits the awards and, you know, maybe you just flip-flop when you announce them every year, and that way it makes it feel like they're both as equally important.
Yeah. Another problem that I could see arising from... I like your idea, but another problem I can see arising is, and I'm just thinking this because I taught a class on genre last semester.
Okay.
Where do we stop the list? All right, you guys...
Do we
add musicals? Because then we're going to have a lot more fucking musicals every year. Do we do westerns? Because westerns are coming back. What about subgenres?
My feeling was looking at whatever are seemingly the most popular genres right now, like maybe 8 to 10 of the most popular genres. And I don't know, maybe one category is kind of a best of the rest.
Okay.
Is kind of a best of the rest. Five slots for five films that either don't fit anything or that aren't, you know, one of the pre-existing sort of categories. I mean, I'm just thinking about, like, in general, if you really think about our movie-going taste right now, westerns are not They're not prevalent.
Right.
There was a time where you could have done it with just Western, but that Absolutely. Doesn't happen. Same thing with musicals. Same thing with...
Do you split horror and thriller, or are they the same category?
No, they have to be split, because horror and thriller, I think, are two different... Especially since, like, a psychological thriller is a totally different kind of movie than a horror movie, I think.
Sure. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about all the genre textbooks that I've read where they make them in the same chapter.
I mean, like, I get that. Oh, believe me, like, I get that. But I don't know. I just think it'd be easier if you had. And also, again, with me, I just want as many films as possible to be nominated. Also, so again, it gives the rooting interest. It gives the interest of, I've seen
movies.
So if you think about it, what that does is that nominates, if you have 10 categories, five each, that's effectively 50 movies nominated for Best Picture. On average in the year, people see 4 movies a year. Chances are they'll probably have seen at least one.
Is that a real number that you just threw out?
So technically speaking, the real number is only one. The average moviegoer only sees one movie a year.
Is that real? I see at least one a week.
Yeah, no, there's a good portion of the population that
doesn't go
to the movies at all, period.
Fuck.
I knew people. I remember work. I worked with a woman who, she told me once that, like, her and her husband hadn't been to a movie since, I want to say, 2010.
Holy shit!
And that was the thing. Like, there are people who just go years and years without going to the movies. And that's fine. But that's the idea, is that we actually have a large portion of our population that doesn't go to the movies at all.
You know, last year ticket sales were up, and some people
2018 was
some up. People said that effect could be credited to MoviePass.
I think
R.I.P. Rest in Paradise, MoviePass.
Well, I was gonna say it's not totally dead. It's not dead yet.
It's dead. It's like your old relative that's in the home. Like, it might as well be dead.
Look, after they made that offer to start doing, like, either 3 movies that you can go see, any 3 movies you want a month, not going to lie, I'm pretty tempted. I may go back. For $20 a month, any 3 movies at any theater, that's pretty tempting.
I do AMC A-List. That's $20 a month for 3 movies a week, which is basically... unlimited.
You're not wrong, but there's only one. There's only that one here on the island.
Yeah, but there's a couple in Jersey that are close to Staten Island.
My concern with the AMC one was just always is like, is there going to be an AMC near me that has basically the indie movies or like the Oscar movies when they come around, and is easy to get to?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I was just looking at the AMC today, and I see Green Book's back. I see like a director's cut of
Is it Star Is Born?
I think it has more music in it.
Yeah, there's like
more,
12
it has
minutes.
More mumbling.
I
Maybe
like Stars.
Maybe it's time to let the old ways die. Maybe it's time to let the old ways die. Date a lot of man.
In the shallows. In the shallow.
Oh my god, it hurts my throat to do Jackson Maine.
Just try. Which is just basically his impression of
Sam Elliott.
Of Sam Elliott.
That's another movie that I liked. But I didn't love. I felt like from the very beginning to Shallows is like a perfect opening act, and then the rest I was just like, this is all over the place. But Best Picture. And all right. Since we're talking about, what's his name? Malick.
Oh, boy.
That's a great impression of Freddie Mercury. But I don't know if I'd call that a performance. But I also don't know if I'd call that a biography. I think of Bohemian Rhapsody as like Mamma Mia. It's a jukebox musical. It's, hey, you like the music of Queen? Here's a story with the music of Queen
in
it.
Then they should have just done the musical that they have in the UK. We Will Rock You.
That's what they should have done. It seems in no way a true biography on Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, no, that movie is just a bag of cats. Like, I don't even...
Well, you have the fucking pedophile director who walked off halfway through but still gets the credit. You've got...
He really disappointed me, Bryan Singer. Like,
I really have liked him as a director in the past.
I think we were talking on Facebook recently about movies that are underrated. And yeah. I said, I love Superman Returns. It's one of my favorite Superman movies.
Superman Returns is
pretty good. And now it's completely untenable because you've got Bryan Singer as director and Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. The whole thing is an awkward watch.
What is fascinating about that is that I remember when that movie came out talking to people.
Yeah.
And people used to tell me basically that you know, it was like, oh, Kevin Spacey and Bryan Singer didn't get along. And I was like, why not? And it's like, because like apparently Brian caught Kevin screwing some boy that he wanted to screw.
What?
And that was in 2006.
This is alleged, folks. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah. Allegedly. But like that was the rumors that were around in 2006. And to think of how everything has sort of come out now, it's just.
I remember rumors that one of the younger X-Men, like one of the kids at the Academy, supposedly Bryan Singer did something to. Who knows?
I hadn't heard that.
But also, we know Bryan Singer was connected to that modeling company that turned out to be like that weird kind of child pornography thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There's a fucking documentary about it, and he's in it. Everything we're saying is alleged. Please don't sue me. But he was part of this so-called modeling company for young boys, and then when it got weird, he distanced himself from it. But he also was like one of the creators of it. He's a weird dude. But I liked his fucking movies.
I was gonna say,
his movies.
That's the problem. Is like he made some good movies. Like, you know, I can't tell. Like, Usual Suspects is a pretty good movie.
Yeah, it is.
I think X2 is still one of the best superhero movies. Period.
Yeah, I like X-Men 1. I like X-Men 2.
X-Men Days of Future Past is really good too.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah, I was actually thinking
recently, I like Valkyrie.
I haven't seen Valkyrie.
That, I think, is kind of an under... Like, look, I know at the time it was viewed as kind of an Oscar hopeful, mm-hmm. but you take all that out, and you just watch it as kind of a straightforward movie.
Yeah.
It's a pretty just solid historical thriller. It does its job. It does what it needs to do.
Okay. You know what's funny about Superman Returns is it made money. I mean, it didn't make a ton of money, but it made money, and it was critically pretty well conceived, mm-hmm. but it is now thought of as a bomb.
Well, it kind of was at the time, too, because I remember that opening weekend.
Uh-huh.
I remember seeing Superman Returns and enjoying it because I'm just a big Superman fan,
mm-hmm.
but not understanding the hate, and then seeing that Monday morning, the box office on it was like $50 million over the weekend, which uh-huh. even in 2006...
Yeah.
That was low.
Yeah.
That
I'm thinking of, yeah. There was an article a couple years ago, and I forget where it was from, that kind of documented the whole thing mm-hmm. in that, you know, it didn't set the world on fire, but it wasn't a failure.
Yeah.
And it also gave some other examples of other movies that we think of as failures that aren't. I just read a biography of Walt Disney, and you're a big Walt Disney fan.
Which one?
I read Animated Man.
Okay, I haven't read that one.
That one focuses more on animation because it's written by an animation historian.
Yeah.
But I was surprised at how many of his movies were like failures in terms of like Fantasia, a failure.
Pinocchio, failure.
Yeah.
Bambi, a failure. So he comes out big and huge with Snow White.
Right.
That's a Titan. That was the highest grossing movie of its day.
Right.
Then he makes Fantasia, Pinocchio, Bambi, all of which bomb.
Right. His next big hit is Dumbo, which he didn't expect because that was kind of low budget,
and the movie, I think, I haven't watched it in years, but it's only like 60 minutes or something.
Mm.
Like it's like 61 minutes something. It's yeah. really, really short.
It's pushing the limit of what we consider a feature film.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually just watched Little Mermaid because it just came out on Blu-ray and 4K.
It's a new Blu-ray. Oh, yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Because yeah. I have it on Blu-ray, but I don't have it the 4K and all that.
Oh, it's some new version then.
Yeah.
And that's pretty short. It's like 83 minutes or 84 minutes.
They used to be a lot shorter. Well, they used to be shorter. And part of the reason was just because hand-drawn animation is so costly and so time-consuming
yeah.
that it just makes sense for it to be shorter. Now with 3D animation, the big difference is that you can do so much more in such a shorter amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to give you an idea, so they spent 4 years making the, you know, a movie like Wreck-It Ralph. They spent 4 years making it. They spend the first 2 years mm-hmm. just doing story. And they are doing tweaks of the movie, like, literally all the way up until just, you know, weeks before it releases.
Because I guess it's so expensive, it's like, we can't go into this. We have to go into this with a perfect story. Which it seems like, from the book I read, Disney often did not do. Like, he would just sort of dick around with stories for a couple of years. Going back to the Oscars, what did you think of Into the Spider-Verse winning Best Animated Feature?
That was one of the awards that I was happiest about for the whole night.
Me too.
Listen, if you told me last year, Mike, you're going to think that the best animated film of the year is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, right, I would have said you were nuts.
Uh-huh.
But I went and saw it, and I was thrilled and delighted. It's just a really, really good movie.
It really is.
There's almost a degree where it's like, it doesn't even matter that it's a Spider-Man movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, Spider-Man is almost incidental to the movie. And the movie could function just as well without Spider-Man, but with something else.
Yeah. It looks amazing. Its comedy is great. Well, that's
the thing, too. Yeah, and this was something I learned recently, is that basically all the animation companies use the same software, which is why everything tends to look pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, they had to basically write new software.
Yeah, yeah.
To make it possible. And that's why it looks so different and why it sticks out and why it works. Part of the reason why it works as well as it does. I was also happy. Now, listen, I love Kathleen Kennedy. I will say she's done a good job for Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think her firing of Chris Miller and Phil Lord was easily the worst decision that she's made there.
Right, because I think they could have given us a very funny, lively Solo.
Yeah, just something different.
Right.
And that for me was a real misstep. I think that was a real mistake.
That's a win for them. Yeah. That movie kind of failed, and Spider-Verse was huge.
I know, and I just love seeing them up there receiving the Oscars and just kind of be like, look what you could have had.
Look what you could have had.
Look what you could have had.
We could have done it. No.
You were 90% of the way there.
Yeah.
Considering 2 weeks before the end of production. That's too late. That's, in my opinion, that's still too late to fire anybody.
Yeah.
I don't know. By that point, you've got the movie you've got. And just deal with it.
You know, but I'm thinking, like, how does the Academy choose best animated? I mean, is it the story? Is it the animation itself? You know, what does that even mean? Because animation is a mode of filmmaking. It's not a genre.
Yeah.
There's animated horror, animated comedy, animated fantasy.
No. That's my biggest gripe, too, is that even within my idea of, like, you're gonna break it up into genres, my hope would be that within those genres, then, you have animated films alongside live-action films.
Yeah.
Animation should not be forced into its own separate category. The only reason at this point that I'm mildly okay with it is just because the unfortunate reality is that they're biased against animated films. And if this is the only way for us to get these amazing films recognized, then, like, let's go for it. Which, by the way, so did you watch the Oscars?
No, I just, I always, the next day, like, watch everything on YouTube. Like, watch all the moments on YouTube.
Totally understand. So, when they were announcing Best Animated Film, they had the presenters start reading off script, talking about how it was kind of associating animated films with being a child.
Fuck that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. It was like, and then it's like, oh, but, you know, we grow up and these films are still really amazing and da-da-da-da. And that's when I was like,
Think about all the anime that's produced in Asia. Like, that, like...
It's like a dumb American thing that we do that I really wish...
The book that I was reading kind of blames Disney. Not to say it's his fault, but his success is why we associate it that way.
But I would argue it would have happened anyway, because let's be honest, at the end of the day, I think what really convinced the older generation that animation is strictly for children is you have a generation that they grew up on they grew up and they said, like, cartoons, all right, so I was a kid and I liked cartoons, but then I grew up and they didn't go along with me, so therefore they sort of stay in that child realm.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have. But it's not like now where we actually have creators who are interested in using animation as a form rather mm-hmm. than a target audience.
I'm looking at a very reliable source, Wikipedia.
Oh, of course.
And I'm looking at the Wikipedia for the Oscars animated. And I know Snow White won an award, but they won a special Academy Award.
Yeah, it was a special recognition.
Because they weren't going to give it Best Picture.
No.
The only animated film that was nominated for Best Picture was 1991's Beauty and the Beast, and that was just a nomination.
Well, actually, Up and WALL-E were also nominated for Best Picture years later.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. So that was the first.
So, yeah, Beauty and the Beast was the first, and Beauty and the Beast was,
Was the only 2D. Is when it began?
Yeah. Oh, the animated best animated feature category is very recent.
So 2002 to now. Wow, that's insane. So that means if you made animated films before 2002, there was just no shot, I guess, other than the short features, maybe?
Pretty much. Like,
wow.
Beauty and the Beast was the rare exception. I mean, I'm actually curious. That's a story that I don't know if anybody's covered, or sadly, probably mm-hmm. it would be difficult to, because it may be too far in the past to kind of ask people about mm-hmm. in terms of their voting thoughts. But I would be really curious to see, because, you know, Oscar campaigning in 91 is not what it is even remotely now.
Right, right. So, I've heard that,
you know,
Harvey Weinstein, for the many evil things he did, he kind of changed and he changed the game of Oscar campaigning and made it more sleazy.
Oh yeah, he's the one who basically made it worse.
Yeah.
There's a really good video on YouTube about that. I'm trying to remember there was a wonderful YouTube video. I can't remember the name of it.
Uh-huh.
That really excellently covers and dissects that specific specific campaign we're talking about is the year that Saving Private Ryan, you know, won Best Director for Steven Spielberg, but lost Best Picture to Shakespeare in Love,
right?
Which, as we all know, is an immortal classic that repeatedly on TNT.
Every Thanksgiving, the family gathers around and we watch Shakespeare in Love. Oh, boy. what your favorite quotes
that one there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite character is William Shakespeare.
Yeah, Ben Affleck is in that movie, yeah.
But that's happened a lot, hasn't it? The best director not won Best Picture.
Well, you know,
doesn't seem intuitive.
It used to be more intuitive.
Yeah.
And then there was, like, that Best Picture, that was sort of, like, the break. That was that year started this path towards it going, you know, it goes one way for director and one way for picture.
It's almost like a way politically to do two at one, like, we'll give this to you,
yeah,
and then, you know, like Spike Lee finally won, right,
for best adapted screenplay,
which is, like, it felt like the way Martin Scorsese won for The Departed. Now I think The Departed's great, but it's not his best movie.
It felt like a lifetime.
Like, all right, we got to give it to you.
But you know what? I would rather. But like Scorsese wins for The Departed, which I still think is one of his great movies, as opposed to, you know, some of these other either filmmakers or some of these other actors who win for, like, a movie that's definitely not, you know, like, if Glenn Close won for The Wife, like,
right, which I didn't see. I know a lot of regular people who were like, I don't even know what the fuck that is.
Yeah, no, I just like ragging. It was kind of because of the fact that it was this movie that came out of nowhere.
Right.
And the joke was for a long time, like, you know, because I think it was released, it had a very brief release.
Right.
And that nobody saw it. And a lot of people were like, the best place to catch The Wife is on Delta Airlines. And
yeah, I don't even, like, I look at movie times almost every day. I don't remember The Wife ever being offered to me.
Yeah, I didn't even, it was this movie that was like, suddenly it's just there. Like, once the award season started, it just suddenly was there. And I was like, where the hell did this thing come from?
But you can just tell by the trailer why it's nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, I haven't even seen the... I don't even know what the movie is about.
It's about infidelity, and it's, like, very, very high drama, and it's an Oscar movie.
And it just has a scene where she gets really quiet.
Yeah.
And then lets him have it with her real anger. Like, that's, like... And that's how you win awards.
Do you think... Alright, so going back to how Return of the King won, again, almost like a here, we wanna acknowledge that you did this trilogy. Do you think when Star Wars Episode 9 happens, it might get something or some even nomination, just like, okay, you finish this new trilogy, here's a little something for you?
This is a fascinating question that is coming up this year.
Yeah.
Between Star Wars and Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
That there's like... That now, we haven't even seen either of these movies.
Yeah.
And already the discussion is sort of beginning, could this be that Return of the King moment? Because the interesting thing with Return of the King was, is that they literally locked them out for like 2 years. Like, they nominated them, but they said, there's no way we're ever going to give Best Picture to a movie about elves and dwarves and wizards. And then they were like, oh, damn, we kind of have to, because if we don't now, we never will.
Right.
not knowing The Hobbit 10 years down the road. But listen, I would like... Here's actually the thing that also I have to say. So this is a combination of things. So I thought Black Panther was a good movie. I think the film was more important socially and culturally.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe than as a piece of filmmaking. Because Ryan Coogler's previous two movies, Fruitvale Station, which is incredible and amazing, and that should have been nominated in its year, and that should have been, you know, respected.
Still haven't seen it.
It is gut wrenching, but it is fantastic.
Really.
And Creed.
Creed, I loved.
It was a movie that I was like, I've never seen a Rocky movie.
Right.
No thoughts on it. I'm not really even a big boxing person.
Yeah.
But that movie, I was like, this is great filmmaking. Like, this is how you make not just a crowd-pleasing movie, but also a great piece of cinema. Yes. And I thought Black Panther was like two-thirds of a really great movie. And then it became a Marvel movie at the end.
Right, right. To me, it was as good as sort of any other Marvel movie.
I think it was important. It was above average. It was above average Marvel movie. But so this is my thinking.
Yeah.
So first off, if Captain Marvel is anywhere near as good as Black Panther...
Yeah.
I think that there should be as much of a push than next year for Captain Marvel for Best Picture. If it is anywhere near as good as Black Panther, then it should be.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's Avengers Endgame, which in a weird way may be the Oscar movie equivalent.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems like it's going to be this dark, dramatic,
kind of turgid. It seems more somber than the last one.
Yeah. Like, it's like we're putting away the childish side of superheroes.
Yeah.
Dealing with the harsh reality of loss.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, that's like the most Oscar thing.
Yeah, sure.
Ever. So it has a shot. And then the question is just with Episode 9, I don't know what kind of... Like, I don't think any of us really know, like, what is the movie that JJ is making? Is he trying to, like, you know, is he trying to make a Return of the Jedi? Or is he really trying to wrap up 9 Star Wars movies?
That's what he says. That's what he has said publicly. And there's even been rumors that there are things in the movie, like a return, like a storyline that takes him to Naboo and stuff like that. Like, there's rumors that it'll feel like not just the end of this trilogy, but the end of the whole story.
Yeah.
But, you know, I tell you what I think it's definitely going to be. It's going to take The Last Jedi completely as canon, but it's going to tonally make a huge shift from it and come back. Which, of course, it always was going to be, because the middle chapter is always the darkest chapter.
But JJ's just a different filmmaker than Ryan.
Absolutely.
Johnson. They're just two different. They're two entirely different people. And that's not a slight against either
one.
No. They're just different people. And so that's the question, is what is... I think that's... I got to be honest, isn't it amazing?
Mm-hmm.
Now between the last, I think this was definitely true of The Last Jedi, and I think it's definitely true so far of Episode 9.
Uh-huh.
We really don't hear anything about what these movies are about. Like, there used to be a lot more, like, leaks, and or not even leaks, even just, like, people talking about it. Like, yeah, we're going to do, like, for any other movie, like, oh, yeah, we're going to do X. We really don't know.
Right.
And we didn't know what Force Awakens was about till we saw it.
Right.
We didn't really know what Last Jedi was about till we saw it, and
they've gotten very good at locking it down.
And I think that is a good thing on some level, instead of overhyping.
And I think there's no there's nothing in them that makes them think, well, we should release details for excitement. They know that the title alone will get you. So it's just sort of like episode 9. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
We don't even have a title yet for it. Typically by this time we would have the subtitle.
Yeah, this is a little weird that we don't have a subtitle. We haven't even had a teaser trailer.
Which maybe will come
with Celebration. At Celebration,
Star Wars Celebration.
Which is April, right?
Yeah. Okay. And God willing, an announcement of Ewan McGregor playing Obi-Wan in that Obi-Wan thing that they have been talking about.
I don't know. Well, that's all really going to depend on this Disney streaming service that I think it could be awesome, but it's funny. The things that I'm interested in are the things that nobody else cares about. So, for example, they've already announced that on the streaming service, there will be two docuseries, one based on the book Ink and Paint, the story of the history of like women in Disney animation.
Oh, interesting.
And the other one is A History of Imagineering.
Oh, that sounds awesome, actually.
Well, the funny thing about that one is we were supposed to get in 2016, a documentary by Leslie Iwerks, who, it's on Netflix right now. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, even though it is a very Pollyanna, Sunshine Rainbows kind of documentary, the Pixar story.
Oh, yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah,
who directed that?
That's Leslie Iwerks. She's related to Ub Iwerks.
Ub, okay.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, so Ub Iwerks is the animator who actually designed Mickey Mouse.
Right, and worked with
Walt.
Very like, early on.
Walt came up with the concept for Mickey, but it was Ub who, like, he worked with and they, like, refined the idea and came up with the geometric shapes that were Mickey Mouse. So, yeah, I think she's the granddaughter of Ub Iwerks. But her documentary is, Pixar story, just as a documentary, is wonderful to watch and very uplifting. And so she was doing a History of Imagineering. It was supposed to come out in 2016. And then it just never came.
Really?
And so I followed her on Facebook and and a lot of people have asked, like, hey, what happened to this? And she's like, we're just still shooting stuff. We're still shooting footage. And then this announcement came that there's going to be this docuseries. So
do you think she stole Buzzy? You think she's behind the Buzzy?
The weird thing about Buzzy is we still don't technically know if it was actually stolen.
Guys, if you don't know what we're talking about, Google where is Buzzy?
Yeah, look up where... what's her name? Did a great video on that.
Oh, Jenny Nicholson.
Jenny Nicholson. Jenny Nicholson did a great video on where's Buzzy. Listen,
he was an animatronic that got stolen. That's the short version of it. Well, we don't know where he is.
Allegedly.
We don't know where he is.
That's the problem. We still don't really know if it was like legit or somebody made it up. Like, Disney's never confirmed or denied it.
Because apparently he's like 1,000 pounds. So, how could you steal him?
And also, like, just to give people at home, if you've never visited Walt Disney World, specifically Epcot, there used to be a pavilion called the Wonders of Life. And in that was a show called Cranium Command, where it was a show where you basically watched this animatronic named Buzzy, who he was like in charge of the brain, of the human brain of a 12-year-old boy. And he has to talk with all the other parts of the body to keep the body, you know, going. And so he has, there's a left brain character played by Chevy Chase, right brain played by, it was like a 90s who's who of comedy. So John Lovitz was the right brain.
Oh, God.
One of the guys from Cheers was in the stomach. I feel like Pauly Shore was in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
this sounds very 90s.
It is the most 90s thing ever, but it was still pretty funny. Anyway, Buzzy is an animatronic and everything else is on these screens, right? As an animatronic, like, and he's on like a kind of like a crane that moves through the show. So if somebody actually stole Buzzy, not only is he like, you know, close to a ton, you cut it. There's going to be hydraulic fluid coming out all over the place. Have you
seen the pictures? He looks kind of hacked out.
Wait, where?
Even the Jenny Nicholson thing, she shows some pictures. It doesn't look like it was somebody who like knew what they were doing and just... Because the things that were connecting him look kind of like hacked at. Guys, this is a mystery.
It is strange. I'll have to look into it some more. But basically, Buzzy. That's fascinating.
You know, thinking about like the popularity of like YouTube shows like Defunctland. Which you don't watch Defunctland, you should. It's all about theme parks. I feel like an Imagineers documentary would be like something really awesome, something a lot of people would like.
Yeah, and I think there's probably more of an interest for it than they realize.
Yeah.
And especially since like, you know, we've heard a lot of the great stories about the construction of Disneyland.
Right.
And some of the stuff for Epcot, but besides those two, like we really, and some of the stuff for Magic Kingdom in Disney World, but like besides that, we really haven't heard, I feel like, a lot of the great stories that I'm sure exist about the process of building these theme parks and constructing these rides, especially something like the sadly recently closed Great Movie Ride.
Yeah,
For which I will never for I love Disney. I will never forget.
And they
them
didn't
for
even have time
their-
to add Green Book into it. Just animatronic fucking Viggo Mortensen
turning to Mahershala Ali.
Oh,
is this how you eat fried chicken?
Oh god!
Oh my god!
All right, we got to wrap it up. But since we're kind of on this topic,
okay,
some details have come out about Galaxy's Edge, the new Star Wars land, and the two e-ticket attractions. Smuggler's Run, which is the Millennium Falcon ride.
Yes.
And Rise of the Resistance.
Rise of the Resistance, yeah.
Which is, they say it's going to be long, it's going to be complicated, it's going to be epic.
Yeah, the rumor is right now it's 28 minutes.
Holy shit.
So, yeah, just to give you guys some...
That's a ride.
Yeah. So let me, okay, so Smuggler's Run, the ride where you are in control of the Millennium Falcon.
Right, I think it's four at a time or five at a time.
Yeah, basically, yeah, there's four seats.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
There's four seats in the cockpit. Yeah, so, you know, picture the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon, but a little longer, and instead of just two seats in the front, two seats behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you have 4 minutes there. And now the ride, as it's going to open, is, honestly, when it opens in Walt Disney World 6 months later, it's not going to be the same ride. Because they're going to learn. Like, I think the big thing is, you know, if when you're in the cockpit, the idea is that all those buttons have a purpose.
Right.
So when you're in there, you can flick one of the buttons and see what happens.
Right. They say everyone will have a different ride performance.
Yeah, which
but
sounds...
That sounds like it could be disastrous.
I was like, this could just go horribly wrong.
Right, like, what do I press to crash the fucking Millennium Falcon?
Well, also, the other rumor, or not rumor, but like something that they've talked about, but we're not really sure how it's going to work.
Uh-huh.
They've talked about how what you do in the ride... could affect things outside of the ride.
Right. Can't you win money? Or you win credits and then you could spend them?
I don't think it's a winning credits. It's more of a you gain a reputation. So there's going to be a lot of roaming characters in Star Wars Land where if you like crash up the Millennium Falcon, they might come up to you and be like, you're a terrible pilot.
Wow.
They want it to be fully
immersive. Like, yeah. When you're in there, you can't buy a Star Wars t-shirt because they wouldn't sell Star Wars t-shirts in Star Wars. So there will be things for sale, and there is going to be like kind of like a Harry Potter wand maker thing, like a lightsaber thing. It's supposed to be highly immersive. Listen,
I'm of two minds about it.
Yeah.
I've been like, this is the thing, as exciting as it sounds, and I think some of it sounds really cool. I'm not big on this idea of overly highly immersive environments.
Right, right.
Because they're not going to ever live up to what people want, or B, just like, in order to construct what people really want, it needs to be Westworld. And like, you can't do it.
Couldn't it be scary for kids?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I'm almost thinking that this stuff isn't for kids. Like, in a weird way, this is the answer to So, if you've ever been to the, either of the, you know, Disneyland, Disney World, they have this thing for, they have a thing for kids, called like, I think it's like Temple of Jedi. Basically, you could do Jedi training, but it's only for kids.
And then
at the end, the kids get to fight a Darth Vader or Kylo Ren. And it's a cool little moment. They're in their little Jedi robes and, you know, it's adorable. And, but every adult is like, well, I want to do that.
Right.
And so there's this point where they're, I feel like, I can't help but feel like they're making a lot of this so that it's like,
I think
like,
they're doing this, that exact thing for adults.
This is
in
for
the
you.
New park.
Then this is what you wanted as an adult. Not that for like kids it would be cool. Because believe me, I remember when they first started this whole My Disney Experience Magic Band thing.
Yeah.
One of the ideas that they had that I hated, and I thank God they never adopted. One of the things they wanted to do was, if you went to meet a character, you could swipe your band to go in. And basically, on the ceiling somewhere would be a screen, and the character would see your name. And so, like, when the kid came in, you know, Ariel could look down and be like, oh, hi, Mike, and say hello. But it's like, and they were like, oh, wouldn't that be so cool that, you know, like, the kids would be like, oh, wow, you know, they know my name. I was like, no, that would be creepy. Why would the characters know our names? Like, that's not
right.
That doesn't make sense. That, you know, she's a mermaid, not psychic. So
you're right, exactly.
Yeah, so they never did that, and I'm super glad that that never really went anywhere. But that was something that they talked about, I know, early on.
I'm trying to find somebody. I don't know if it was real or not, but somebody sent me like the badge that people working in the park will have.
Oh, like the name tag?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it looks Star Warsy, but it's almost like a simplistic Star Warsy a representation of the castle.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find
it. That sounds like them. But anyway, so just real quick. So in terms of the highly immersive environment is really cool on some level, but it's also this feeling of like, how do you know when people are playing along? How do you know when people aren't? How do you know? Like, how do you? I also just think that they end up spending so much money on making these exteriors that they don't end up making very good interiors. That's an issue I've sort of long had. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Sorry, I'm looking at the, for those of you listening, I'm looking at the name tags that basically anybody who's working in Star Wars Land will be wearing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty nice design.
Yeah, it's like cool looking.
Yeah.
I just see a little kid being scared. I could see a little kid.
Listen, I look. This is the thing, because now I'm a big fraidy cat.
Yeah.
In general, I don't like simulators and I don't like roller coasters.
Mm-hmm.
So. The Millennium Falcon, I'm just going to have to take Xanax or something and get on it. Although, maybe I might be okay with it because I'm allowed to be the pilot. So everyone in my party is just going to have to deal with the fact that I'm going to be the pilot.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing any dives or anything. Like, we're gonna keep this like a steady run.
Yeah.
But, so there's that.
Yeah.
The other ride, Rise of the Resistance, sounds awesome.
Mm.
However, at the very end, it's supposed to be your cart, your ride vehicle goes into basically an elevator shaft, and it's supposed to make it look like you're flying back down to the planet.
Yeah.
But in reality, they're dropping you like in Tower of Terror.
I'm also a big scaredy cat.
Yeah.
That's why I never went on Jurassic Park, because I know it ended with a drop.
Jurassic, I did it once, and that's the thing. Okay. Oh, funny story, speaking of Jurassic Park. So Steven Spielberg is like us, because when Steven Spielberg rides the ride, he just gets off at the top and doesn't go down the drop.
Of course.
And that's why he's my hero.
So yeah.
Because I would go on it every time if I didn't need to do the drop.
Right. Yeah. See, I'm not like you with the simulation. I'm fine with simulation because I know it's not real.
Yeah, I get that.
Roller coasters I can't do. Drops I don't like.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? Like, I remember when I did Jurassic Park the ride, it was one of those, like, it's a steep, the other thing that's crazy is a steep drop.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, flat, steep drop, and that, unlike a lot of Disney stuff, like, I know Splash Mountain, which I've only done once, but still, that was actually a more rounded Right.
Like, you're really not dropping, per se, for that long.
Right.
Whereas Jurassic Park, it was like this 100-foot steep.
Right, right.
You scream. I remember screaming, taking a breath, and then screaming again.
Yeah. All right, Mike. I think we fixed the Oscars here today.
By talking about everything else but the Oscars. I feel like we talked about everything else but the Oscars.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about. Thank you for being here, Mike Fischetti.
No problem. Thank you.
You're Mike. Always welcome on the show. This is Pop Culture Man Children, PCMC. This podcast is available everywhere podcasts are available.
Well, there's iTunes, Stitcher,
Spotify, Google Play. Follow at Pop Culture Man Children on Instagram. And all right. Bye bye.